Throughout our study in Exodus, one of the things that I have like just not really been able to shake and that's kind of stuck with me all throughout this series is God's patience with his children, the nation of Israel, throughout the first 18 chapters that we have covered so far. His patience with his children, despite the fact that they want to go about things their own way, they want to live outside of God's design, and they don't really seem to trust God, that God's provision will carry them forward beyond the step that he's already taken them to. And on Monday, I got a little glimpse of what this might feel like for God. On Monday afternoon, evening, I was preparing dinner. My wife was working. All three kids were home. And I had them do a little activity while I got the food all out on the plates and got the dinner table all set up. And I thought, all right, I'm going to be a good dad. We're going to have some meaningful conversation. We might even talk about the Bible at the dinner table and really try and have a little Bible study with my kids. And then chaos broke out. I sat all the kids down. The four-year-old said, I don't like it. The 11-year-old decided because the 4-year-old wasn't eating that he would try and get his sister to laugh the whole time at dinner. And then the 9-year-old, who has braces, got food stuck in her teeth, so she was messing around with her teeth and showing the food in her mouth. So then the 4-year-old and the 11-year-old are laughing at the 9-year-old. And then the 9-year-old says, well, I'll get on this laughing thing, and I'll try and get my 4-year-old sister to laugh about me messing with my teeth. So everything's just like going crazy. Then two of them decide, well, I need to go get water now, because they didn't have any water. Dad forgot about one piece of it, right? Then the 4-year-old decided she wanted to sit in a different spot. She didn't want to sit by daddy. She wanted to sit somewhere else. So all of these things are happening. I'm like, I just want to try and talk about our days, kids. Can we just do that? And then, you know, with four or three young kids, 4 and 11 years old in between there, the one thing, all it takes is just this one thing. If somebody toots, it's all over. It's all over, because then everything is all about bathroom talk, if you will, for the rest of the dinner time. So at some point, I just decided, you know what? It's not happening. This conversation that I thought we might be able to explore around the Bible and our days and that sort of thing, I give up. I'm going to go do the dishes. And that, you know, as I made that logical conclusion, which was the right conclusion to make, by the way, I thought about Exodus. I thought, what is God's response to his people when they are impatient, not trusting, going about things their own way, when their dinner mannerisms and behaviors are in some ways unacceptable? What was my knee-jerk reaction when my kids were off the rails? I just moved on. We'll try it another day. I'll move on. What's God's response to his people? To continue to pursue and to provide. And that's really what comes to mind for me as we come to our passage today. We're going to be studying the Ten Commandments. And I think we often view these as very rigid rules. But my hope is that when we look at the Ten Commandments within the story of Exodus, as we've been covering it for the last 7 weeks, my hope is that when we view it within the story, we'll begin to see these rules and regulations in a far different light and bring new life to them for us. As I mentioned last Sunday, as we came to Exodus chapter 16, that a major shift in the book had happened. God had delivered the people out of Egypt and out of slavery through the Red Sea and led them into a place of freedom. It was a story about God saving his people up to that point. But then last week really became a focus on God forming his people, sanctifying them, making them his, so that they could not only be in right relationship with him, but so that they would be a reflection of who he is to the nations and the people around them. Before we get to the Ten Commandments, which is in Exodus chapter 20, we really have to look at the lead up to Exodus 20, which is Exodus 19, which takes us to a place of significance in the book of Exodus. We come to Mount Sinai, which is also in the Bible called Mount Horeb, or also called the Mountain of God. And when I say all those terms, you might remember something we studied in Exodus 3 many, many weeks ago at this point. Exodus 3, and a promise that God gave Moses as he was speaking to him through the burning bush. In Exodus 3, verse 12, God said this as they're on Mount Sinai. He said, I will be with you, and this will be a sign to you that it is I who have sent you. And when you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. So this is a foreshadowing of what we're going to be covering today as the people come to worship God on the mountain of God. And what God is really doing is he's bringing them back to this place of significance to Moses to have what I would describe as a divine DTR. A DTR is a determine the relationship conversation. All of you, if you have gotten married at any point in your life, have had a DTR. It's the conversation that you have with somebody that you like being around, and both of you are trying to figure out if it's mutual or not. And somebody has to take the first jump to say, I like hanging out with you. And then the other person says, yeah, me too. And then you have to decide, well, what is this relationship that we have? What do we call it? And what are the ground rules for our relationship and the way that it's meant to function? Are we dating? Are we exclusive? Are we working toward marriage? What is the commitment? And what are the expectations involved? That is what God is doing with the Israelite people here in Exodus 19 and 20. And it starts off with God making a very specific declaration about how he feels about the nation of Israel. In chapter 19, as they come to the mountain of God, Moses is told by God to tell the people these things in verses 4 through 6 of Exodus 19. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. That's God's declaration about how he sees the nation of Israel. And it's really amazing that in these three verses, what God is highlighting is past, present, and future. Verse 4, the past, he says, you have seen what I did in Egypt and how you were carried on eagle's wings, which is poetic language to describe God carrying the people through the water of the Red Sea to a place of deliverance. And then in verse 5, it describes God's present picture and feeling about his relationship with the nation of Israel. He says then, describing the present, as you seek to follow me, you will be in the present my treasured possession. And what's really amazing about this is think about all the ways that the people have been disobedient to God up to this point. And God is still saying, if you will follow me, you will be my treasured possession. And then at the very end, verse 6 of what we just read highlights the way that they will continue to be into the future when he says, you will become a kingdom of priests in a holy nation. It's almost like a quotation that Peter uses in 1 Peter chapter 2 in describing those who follow Jesus, the church, and the way that God views them, a holy nation, a royal priesthood, God's chosen, treasured possession. That's what Peter describes in 1 Peter 2. So we have past, present, and future, and God is declaring the way that he sees these people. He's put himself out there in this DTR sort of conversation. And then something amazing happens. And you could read the rest of chapter 19, but I'll just summarize it. God invites the people to consecrate themselves for 3 days. Consecration is just a fancy Bible word that essentially means to cleanse yourself and then to devote yourself. It's to shed off something that might hold you back and then to pursue something in a new and a fresh way. It's preparation for what God is going to do. And so for 3 days, they consecrate themselves. And then on the third day, God comes in the form of thunder and lightning, a cloud that covers the mountain, and then a loud trumpet blast sounds. And this is the people's, as Moses leads them, this reminder that now they can approach the Lord. And Moses goes up the mountain and has a conversation with God, and God says, actually, you need to go back and get Aaron. And as he comes down the mountain, this is what God says. Exodus chapter 20, we're going to look at verses 1 through 17. Moses has come down the mountain, it says at the very beginning of chapter 20, and God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. This is the word of the Lord. The Ten Commandments, which are a very interesting study, even just from a historical standpoint, in terms of how Christians view them. On the one hand, you have Christians who have been trying for centuries to get the Ten Commandments displayed in every public institution building possible. And this has led to many lawsuits that have come all the way to the Supreme Court. For instance, in 2005, the Supreme Court upheld a ruling by a lower court in Alabama, which said that the display of the Ten Commandments at the state courthouse in Alabama violated the religious freedom of Alabama citizens and had to be removed. And then a very similar ruling in 2017 in New Mexico, where the Ten Commandments were displayed at a monument, a state monument, and were also removed for very similar reasons. And so you have, on one hand, Christians who say these Ten Commandments should be the foundational laws and understandings about functioning as people in our society. But then on another hand, you would have some Christians that, quoting Romans 6, would say, we don't live under law, we live under grace. And the Ten Commandments have no bearing on how we are called to live as followers of Jesus. And so which is it? The Ten Commandments should be displayed and followed by everybody and are undergirding the foundation of our society as we operate in relationship with one another, or they're irrelevant. And the grace of Jesus is what covers us, and we no longer need to follow the Ten Commandments. So as I thought about, like, how the heck do you teach all of these Ten Commandments? And how do you then do it in a way that fits within this kind of overarching question? I mean, we could go through these individually. We could talk about no other gods, no images, don't use the Lord's name in vain, keep the Sabbath, honor your father and mother, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't lie, don't covet. We could talk about these and break them down all individually, but rather than doing that, I thought it would be most helpful if we talked about some guiding principles that we see from these commandments that then will allow the 10 and the 10, the way that they speak to us, to hopefully have a better understanding of their rightful place in our lives. And so it begins with this. The commandments teach relationship before rules. We read them as rules, but what we see in verse 2, when God says, before he gives the Ten Commandments, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. And verse 2, in many ways, kind of echoes what God says in Exodus 19, at the very beginning of their time at Mount Sinai, when he explains what he did for them, taking them out of Egypt. It was his work that brought about relationship. It was his rescue that led to a relationship that is now being worked on to further establish by God bringing about these rules to them at this place. And so this point cannot, I believe, be overstated, that the relationship that God desires comes before he gives the rules. And when we get those things flipped around, we can view God as rather demanding and kind of a micromanager, that he wants us to be so specific in the way that we live. But put within its place in Exodus, we see these rules as not establishing a nation and a people for God, but these rules are the necessary outworking of God's gracious rescue of these people. Here's how one theologian describes this reality. He says, the Israelites were not told to keep the law so that God might save them and they could be his people. He already had saved them, and they already were his people. So the point isn't just to establish more rules. The point is that he wanted to be in relationship. And this was then the outworking of that. These are a response to God's rescuing and establishing of a relationship, not the means of achieving the rescue and establishing the relationship. And what we often do is we get those flipped around. And it's within this understanding that we can see God's demands and his commandments as really an act of grace, a way to live in relationship with God and each other. I think of a great picture of one of the ways that the commandments and the laws of God function are as a map pointing to a destination. Before we all had devices that we carried with us into our cars that would give us GPS navigation, we would, before going on a road trip, pull out the Rand McNally and chart our path along the physical map to get to our destination the best way we knew how, the way that looked quickest. And that's what these commandments are functioning like, a way, a path toward right relationship with God. And it becomes this picture of grace, even with the way that they're given. Later on in Exodus, we learn that when God gave these Ten Commandments, Moses wrote them down on two tablets. And we don't really know exactly what was written on these two tablets. It could be that they were so long that they took up two tablets. But more than likely, what took place is that Moses wrote them down twice, because they were an aspect of God's covenant with his people. And what happens when you establish a contract or a covenant with somebody is that you each get a copy of it when you walk away from your negotiation with one another, so that each of you knows what's on the line for the other. And so they would have two copies. And we could read on in Exodus 25, which is a passage that we're going to look at next week as we look at the establishing of the tabernacle. But one of the aspects of the tabernacle is inside the Holy of Holies was the Ark of the Covenant and then the mercy seat. And underneath the mercy seat, the Israelites placed the two tablets of the law, of these commandments. And for me, it's a picture of grace. The mercy seat is the place where the blood of the sacrifice would be sprinkled, cleansing the people from sin. And it's underneath that where the commandments were placed. God is not trying to place high demands on us. He's trying to show us a picture of grace by allowing us to walk into right relationship with him. So that's really the first foundational aspect of the commandments. They establish relationship. It's a picture of grace. And then the second part, the commandments help get the Egypt out. Verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me, is a very anti-Egypt statement and rule. And why I say that is you have to remember that for 400 years, the Israelites lived in slavery in Egypt. Generation after generation after generation adapted and learned how to live in Egyptian society. And Egyptians were known to be polytheistic and pantheistic, meaning they believed in many gods, and they believed that the gods inhabited created things like water, like the sun, like land, like frogs. And so this sort of society is where they lived in for generation after generation after generation. And here God is saying, you shall have no other gods before me. And the other rules and regulations from the commandments that follow. And so it makes sense that the first four of these commandments are all about their relationship with God. They're all centered on Him. No other gods before me, no worshiping of images or idols. Don't use the Lord's name in vain. Rest on the seventh day so that you can center your life around the Lord and not around your work. And in this way, I think we can see another picture of the commandments as functioning like guardrails. Guardrails that are meant to keep us from going where we might otherwise go. As people who are coming out of slavery, the Israelites were likely to kind of move away from this one God who was demanding their devotion, because they, for 400 years, had done things so differently and been around people who were so different than that. It shows us that the commandments were really meant to form the people into relationship with God. They're being reformed out of Egypt and into the way that God wants them to live. I've used this example before, but I think a great picture, a mental image of this is right outside my living room window. All winter long, there's an oak tree that doesn't lose all of its leaves. There's some dead leaves that kind of hang on all winter. All the windstorms, rainstorms, they never fall down. The only way to get rid of the dead is for new life to come in its place. And just in the last few weeks, as leaves have begun to sprout on this oak tree, the dead leaves fall off. And then I have more leaves to rake, ironically, in the spring. But it's a picture of the only way to get rid of the Egypt isn't just to leave Egypt, but it's to form your life in a whole new way. And the commandments are meant to guard you against from going back to where you might go otherwise. Oftentimes, we will think of following Jesus as just simply about believing and having faith, but we'll do very little to reshape our lives to follow Christ in a more significant way. We want to follow Jesus, but we don't want to adjust our life for Him. And what the commandments are meant to do is to keep us from going where we might otherwise go. They're guardrails to keep us on that path, because God knows that we're prone to wander and prone not to adjust our life for Him. One of the interesting aspects about the commandments to me is that there's 10 of them. And I have to believe that this is intentional, because earlier on in Exodus, God provided what is called 10 plagues earlier on around the nation of Egypt to show them who was the Lord. And one of the things that we talked about when we covered the plagues is that they were God's way of decreating, of deforming what God had made through the creation. And He was showing His power that He could make something and then cause it to move into chaos and to begin to fall apart. And so we have that as the 10 plagues. But now covering the 10 commandments, God is drawing a contrast here between the two. If the plagues were about decreation, the commandments are about recreation, about reforming what has been fallen apart and shaping His people to then live in harmony with God and with others. In fact, when Jesus is asked about the Ten Commandments, somebody asks Him, what's the greatest commandment? In other words, of these 10, which is most important? And Jesus says something really interesting in Mark 12. He's trying to summarize the Ten Commandments. And this is our memory verse for the month of April, Mark 12, verses 30, and then we'll continue on and look at verse 31 as well. He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength. That's our memory verse right there. And then he continues on. The second commandment is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. Love God and love others. That's Jesus' summary of the Ten Commandments. And when you read through the Ten Commandments, you can begin to see how they really all boil down to those two points, loving God and loving others. And then the last point I want to draw us into about the commandments is the commandments destroy idolatry. And we see this in the 10th commandment, verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. The 10th commandment is about making an idol out of somebody else's stuff. And then it echoes the first commandment, which says, you shall have no other gods before me. An idol is anything that we put in the place of God as the sole focus and aspiration of our lives. Anything that we desire above God. So when you covet something or someone, you have made it an idol because you valued it as above the Lord, because you want that more than you want to honor God. And it then goes back to the first commandment, which also focuses on idolatry, which sometimes we want other things other than God. You shall have no other gods before me. Martin Luther said that he believed that God organized it in this way, bookended with commandments about idolatry, because he believed that these two helped inform all the others. Why do we steal? Why do we lie? Because we covet something that's not truly ours, and we want it more than we want to honor God and love others. Why don't we rest? Why do we worship other gods? Because we want something else other than truly honoring God with our lives. The problem with idols isn't just that we have them, it's that often we don't realize that we have them in our lives. And Tim Keller has what I think is a really helpful kind of diagnostic statement to help us figure out where are the idols in my life that I'm having a blind spot toward. I can't really see them. And here's his just short, simple statement. My life has meaning and I have worth if. And you could kind of fill in the rest of that blank to help discover idols in your life. My life has meaning and I have worth if I can get a lot of stuff done. That's the idol of work. My life has meaning and I have worth if I have a lot of money. That's the idol of money, obviously. My life has meaning and I have worth if I can go on a nice vacation, or I can drive a nice car, or I can wear nice clothes, or have nice things. That's the idol of materialism. My life has meaning and I have worth if my kids are happy, if my wife is happy, if my parents are happy. That's the idol of family. My life has meaning and I have worth if the person I'm dating or the person that I'm married with is perfectly happy all the time and totally in love with me. That's the idol of a relationship. And none of these things in and of themselves are bad. Oftentimes, God brings these things and these people into our lives as a blessing to us. But what we often do is place them on the pedestal of our lives. We can turn just about anything into an idol. So the fact that the commandments are bookended by idolatry and then speak to different ways that we can abuse and distort things that God has brought into our lives as a blessing should tell us something about the potential problems that we might have in our lives of worshiping other things other than God. And in this way, I think the commandments can function like a mirror. We've talked about a map, guardrails, but they can function like a mirror as well. What does a mirror do? It shows you all your imperfections. You all stood in front of a mirror, probably this morning, to make your hair just look just right and make sure your shirt was put on correctly and that your clothes matched so you didn't look weird coming to church. They can function like a mirror to highlight the imperfections and the sinfulness that we have in our lives. And so we've seen this within the setting of Exodus, the value of the commandments, not just to be rules and regulations for God, but as a way to shape and mold a people to be formed into a greater reflection of who God is, this God who saved us. But still, I know that there are many of you that sit here and listen like, oh yeah, you know, that's great, but the Ten Commandments aren't really authoritative for us. Paul even says, Romans 6:14, for sin shall no longer be your master because you are not under the law, but under grace. That's what Paul says. So how do we understand the Ten Commandments if we are people who no longer under the law, but under grace? Or maybe we could ask this question very simply. Are we under the law or under grace? That's a great, like, small group discussion question, because the answer is nuanced. But here's how I would answer that question. Are we under the law or under grace? As a way to kind of understand the Ten Commandments and how they then apply to us. My simple answer to that question is yes. Are we under the law or under grace? Yes. But let me explain myself. I say that because it's the law that points to our need for grace, because we simply cannot uphold it in our sinfulness. It points out our need for grace. But then it is grace that leads us back to the law and devotion to God and wanting to be in right relationship with him. But not everybody agrees with my statement. A few years ago, a pastor named Andy Stanley, who's a pretty well-known pastor in Atlanta, he wrote a book about the Bible. And in it, he talks about the Old Testament and the Ten Commandments. And this is a quote from his book. He says, "The Ten Commandments have no authority over you, none. Thou shalt not obey the Ten Commandments." That's what he said. And I get what he's trying to emphasize. He's trying to emphasize that we are people who live under grace. And we don't need to be under laws and rules and regulations. And he would highlight passages like Romans 7, which says that following God's rules is not enough to save us. And it's true. You could follow all the Ten Commandments and still live outside of relationship with God, because it is the grace of Jesus that you need to truly save you. But then there's Jesus, who said that he came not to abolish the law. He didn't come to get rid of it, but he came to fulfill it. So there has to be some aspect in which the law then applies to us and we can think about its value in our own lives. Jesus, about the Ten Commandments, when he was asked about it, he says, "You've heard it was said, do not murder. But anybody who gets angry with somebody else, you have committed murder in your own heart." And then he goes on to say, "You've heard it was said, do not covet your neighbor's wife. But anybody who has lusted after somebody has committed adultery." And so he takes the Ten Commandments and says, oh, by the way, nobody can keep them. Not in the way that I understand them. Nobody can keep them. He doesn't abolish them. He fulfills them and points everybody back to him as the grace that is needed to cover their inability to keep the law. So how do we put these two things together? Clearly the law has some purpose and value for us, but how do we understand it in light of grace? And I think this quote from Jen Wilkin summarizes it quite well. She says, "The law drives us in desperation to grace, but grace drives us in devotion back to the law." When we receive from God the grace that is offered to us in Jesus that we need because we recognize our inability to uphold the law and the sinful bent that we have toward breaking God's demands and his pattern for right relationship with him. When we recognize that, we then honor God by using the grace that he has given us that then empowers us to seek after pursuing right relationship with him in the way that God has outlined and designed for us. It becomes, again, a path, a map for devotion back to the Lord. On the Sunday of Easter, we looked at, as the crossing of the Red Sea, how the Israelite people were very quickly drawn back into their former life as they faced a little adversity. And that was because they were viewing freedom through a very narrow lens. Freedom from them, for them was just freedom from their former way of life. But once they figured out that going out into the middle of the desert could actually be worse for them, they thought, well, we'll just go back to that old way of living. But how that picture of freedom is very incomplete, because true freedom is the ability to choose what you will give yourself to fully. It's a freedom for something. Not just freedom from a releasing of the things that held you back, but a freedom for choosing what you will willfully give your life to. And all of us, whether we like it or not, we're giving our lives and our devotion to someone or something. And often the question for us to ask is, what is it that we are giving our lives to? We see in Jesus somebody who lived under the law and followed it perfectly and yet took on the punishment of the law. The punishment that you and I deserved for falling short of God's demands. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And the weight of God's judgment and his wrath fell upon Christ. He was wounded and bruised and ultimately killed for our sake. God in his grace made him who knew no sin to be sin for us. And it was as his blood was shed and sprinkled upon the mercy seat that the grace of God came into our lives by faith. And now in Christ, there is no condemnation for you and I who take that step of faith. We don't follow the rules of God to get the love of God. That love is offered to us in Christ. We follow the rules of God because we have received love from God. We have a freedom for, a willful choice to put God front and center in our lives, to make him the one that we are devoted to. And when we make that choice, we will then, empowered by his grace, choose to live in the way that he has outlined for us. It's not a way to earn salvation, but the commandments are a way to follow in light of the salvation that has been given to us. Francis Schaeffer was once asked if he had time to spend with non-believers, how he would utilize the time. And he said, if I had 1 hour to spend with non-believers, I would spend 50 or 55 minutes getting them lost. And I'd spend 5 to 10 minutes getting them saved. The commandments do a great job of getting us lost. They highlight our need for a Savior, of recognizing that we fall short. But then, empowered by the grace that we have received through God, they push us back into following God and seeking after him and loving others the way that God has designed. These rules that God has given us are not a way for us to earn his love, but they're a way for us to follow and to walk in the love that he's given us. I want to invite the worship team to join me up here as we take time to respond. And I'd like to, as they're coming up, just lead us in a prayer of devotion to the Lord. Now and then I like to read out of the Valley of Vision, which is a Puritan prayer book written by many authors and pastors many, many years ago. And there's a prayer called devotion. And I think what the commandments really highlight for us is a life that's fully devoted to God will live in the way that God has designed for us. It's a question of devotion. What are you truly going to give your life to? And so as we pray, I'd just like to pray a part of this prayer of devotion as a way of saying to the Lord that we all want to be devoted to him. Would you join me in prayer? God, it is our greatest and noblest pleasure to be acquainted with you. It is sweet to look into my being when all of my power and passion are united in pursuit of you, when my soul longs and passionately breathes, conforming to you with enjoyment of you. No hours pass with so much pleasure as those spent in communion with you in my heart. How desirable, how profitable it is to be in the spirit of holy watchfulness and seeing godly jealousy over me when my soul is afraid of nothing except grieving and offending you, the blessed God, my Father and friend, who I then love and long to please rather than being happy in myself. I long to fill all my time for you, whether at home or at work, to place all my concerns in your hands, to be entirely at your disposal, having no will or interest of my own. Help me to live for you forever, to make you my last and only end, so that I may never more in one instance love my sinful self, but instead love you. God, those words echo in our hearts, in our lives. And even as we've covered commandments and rules and laws and regulations, we see a picture of grace that you long for us to draw near to you and then to shape and mold our lives so that we can not only be a reflection of you as we feel you close, but a reflection of you when we feel drawn and distant, pulled away. These bring us back to relationship with you. So give us the strength and the perseverance to put you first, to align our lives after you, so that we can love you and love others in the way that you design. We are devoted to you. We ask this in Jesus' name.